Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, an eye-opening audio tapestry woven around Richard K. Moore's fine essay, Escaping the Matrix. To take the red pill, just stay tuned. Remember The Matrix? That was a science fiction movie of 1999. A bad movie, in mine humble opinion, but a movie with some real cultural significance. Keanu Reeves played the young hero, Neo, who swallows the red pill of truth and discovers that the middle-class ordinary world of his experience is entirely false. A simulation. The Matrix. Outside the Matrix, in reality, humans are drugged and enslaved until their bodies are harvested by powerful forces of which the people have not the slightest inkling. I know what you're thinking. That sounds a lot like the Western world under the rule of neoliberal economics and transnational corporate capitalism. A bright and talented essayist named Richard K. Moore thought so too. His essay, Escaping the Matrix, was published in 1999. Lynn Gary, producer of the radio program Unwelcome Guests, read the essay aloud in a broadcast of 2002. New World Notes rebroadcasts Lynn's reading in 2017. Now, Robin Upton, Unwelcome Guests' current producer, has taken things a step further. He has woven Lynn's reading of the essay into a tapestry. He has woven in other voices, additional content that supplements and complements and gives specific examples of Richard K. Moore's main points. We heard a different audio tapestry of Robin's, The Terror Threat, a few months ago. Here's a new one. Robin's Matrix tapestry runs for an hour and a half. I plan to divide it into 5 or 6 installments and to broadcast at least most of it. Maybe not all in a row. The numbers Robin occasionally speaks identify the Unwelcome Guests installment from which each new thread comes. If you want to hear more of that thread, you can look up that installment at unwelcomeguests.net. Are you ready for the red pill? We begin with Robin Upton's own voice.
We live now in a world in which every year corporate media admits that economic wealth and privilege is concentrated in ever fewer hands, and yet at the same time manages to keep off the table any real discussion about whether we would like to change this and how we might do this. To my eyes, that's a major glitch in the matrix. For an expose of just how that contradiction came to be, we turn to one of our major pieces. This is Richard K. Moore's essay, Escaping the Matrix, which Lynn Gary read in episode 87.
Moore begins the article by asking, "Are you ready for the red pill?" The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes a red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, true reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the Matrix world, True reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for. In consensus reality, the blue pill perspective, left and right are two ends of the political spectrum. Politics is a tug of war between competing factions carried out by political parties and elected representatives. Society gets pulled this way and that within the political spectrum, reflecting the interests of whichever party won the last election. The left and right are therefore political enemies. Each side is convinced that it knows how to make society better. Each believes the other enjoys undue influence, and each blames the other for the political stalemate that apparently prevents society from dealing effectively with its problems. This perspective on the political process, and on the roles of left and right, is very far from reality. It is a fabricated collective illusion. Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix. Later, we'll take a fresh look at the role of left and right and at national politics. But first, we must develop our red pill historical perspective. I've had to condense the arguments to bare essentials. Please see the annotated sources at the end for more thorough treatments of particular topics. Imperialism and the Matrix. From the time of Columbus to 1945, world affairs were largely dominated by competition among Western nations seeking to stake out spheres of influence, control sea lanes, and exploit colonial empires. Each Western power became the core of an imperialist economy whose periphery was managed for the benefit of the core nation. Military might determined the scope of an empire. Wars were initiated when a core nation felt it had sufficient power to expand its periphery at the expense of a competitor. Economies and societies in the periphery were kept backward to keep their populations under control, to provide cheap labor, and to guarantee markets for goods manufactured at the core. Imperialism robbed the periphery not only of wealth, but also of its ability to develop its own societies, cultures, and economies in a natural way for local benefit. The driving force behind Western imperialism has always been the pursuit of economic gain, ever since Isabella commissioned Columbus on his first entrepreneurial voyage. The rhetoric of empire concerning wars, however, has typically been about other things. The white man's burden, bringing true religion to the heathens, manifest destiny, defeating the yellow peril or the Hun, seeking Laban's realm, or making the world safe for democracy. Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time. The propaganda lies of yesterday were recorded and became consensus history, the fabric of the matrix. While the costs of territorial empire, fleets, colonial administrations, etc., were borne by Western taxpayers generally, the profits of imperialism were enjoyed primarily by private corporations and investors. Government and corporate elites were partners in the business of imperialism. Empires gave government leaders power and prestige, and gave corporate leaders power and wealth. Corporations ran the real business of empire while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics.
641.
As with Serbia, and more recently Libya, events in Haiti were sold to the public as humanitarian intervention. This technique has long been used as a justification for imperialism. Originally, the idea was to civilize the savages, then to promote what was termed democracy. In the early 20th century, General Smedley Butler described with remarkable candor his actual role in the U.S. Army. "I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested." Butler summed up his message with four simple words: "War is a racket."
656.
We switched into a more subtle phase of the ancient Monroe Doctrine, where instead of using Marines so much with gunboat diplomacy, we created a National Guard with officers trained at our academies here in the States, and then maintained control of the country by proxy without taking the heat for having our troops inside the country itself. It's been said that this event was the birth of neocolonialism. This also was the kickoff of the U.S. policy of establishing a military oligarchy. We set up schools and trained tens of thousands of military and police officers in countries all over Latin America and Africa in some cases, and Asia, putting them through our academies, arming them, paying their salaries afterwards, trying to create and successfully creating a situation where we would have a fraternity of people in these countries in power who were more loyal to the fraternity of our own military than they were to the peasants and people of their own countries. Meanwhile, this cat and mouse game that we've played with Nicaragua since 1981 is a classic case of what CI directors more recently themselves called destabilization. The point is to put pressure on the targeted government by ripping apart the social and economic fabric of the country. Now that's words, you know, social and economic fabric. That means making the people suffer as much as you can until the country plunges into chaos, until at some point you can step in and impose your choice of governments on that country. The rationales we've used in Nicaragua are classic. We've been fighting communism. It's been national security. They're a Marxist bastion in our own backyard and all of that.
Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics. Industrialization, beginning in the late 1700s, created a demand for new markets and increased raw materials. Both demands spurred accelerated expansion of empire. Wealthy investors amassed fortunes by setting up large-scale industrial and trading operations, leading to the emergence of an influential capitalist elite. Like any other elite, capitalists used their wealth and influence to further their own interests however they could. And the interests of capitalism always come down to economic growth. Investors must reap more than they sow, where the whole system comes to a grinding halt. Thus, capitalism, industrialization, nationalism, warfare, imperialism, and the Matrix co-evolved. Industrialized weapon production provided the muscle of modern warfare, and capitalism provided the appetite to use that muscle. Government leaders pursued the politics necessary to expand empire while creating a rhetorical matrix around nationalism to justify those policies. Capitalist growth depended on empire, which in turn depended on a strong and stable core nation to defend it. National interests and capitalist interests were inextricably linked, or so it seemed, for more than two centuries.
640.
Well, grand area strategy was developed really during the Second World War, and it continued to develop afterwards in the early stages of the Cold War. This is grand kind of world order planning. And most of the evidence that we have for this and the direction it took came out of the Council on Foreign Relations working group that was set up in the 1940s with the State Department called the War and Peace Studies Project. And most of this material is now declassified and available. The documents that have come out really reveal a very kind of imperial, openly imperial mindset. I mean, there was the language spoke openly about establishing a Pax Americana. It talked about the necessity of transitioning away from British imperial rule to a new form of American global domination. It openly talked about limiting the sovereignty of different countries depending on their amenability to the principles of this new global economic and political order that the United States and Britain envisaged. It spoke about the need to establish international institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF and the United Nations as mechanisms to regulate this world order, but quite openly spoke about doing this in the interests of the advanced industrial countries such as Britain, the United States and Western Europe. So on the one hand, even though there was this sense of benevolence, there was this idea that if we don't set up these institutions, there will be this international stability and there will be this danger of Nazism. There was also this quite candid admission it would protect the economic interests of a specific group of states and the interests of the colonies themselves and the kind of these countries in the less developed world that were trying to breaking out at this time, kind of struggling for national independence, that their interests were really not in the equation. And there were even references to the need to use propaganda to legitimize this whole new structure to domestic publics.
I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000, continuing. World War II and Pax Americana. 1945 will be remembered as a year World War II ended and the bond of the atomic nucleus was broken. But 1945 also marked another momentous fission, the breaking of the bond between national and capitalist interests. After every previous war, and in many cases after severe devastation, European nations had always picked themselves back up and resumed their competition over empire. But after World War II, a Pax Americana was established. The U.S. began to manage all the Western peripheries on behalf of capitalism generally, while preventing the communist powers from interfering in the game. Capitalist powers no longer needed to fight over investment realms, and competitive imperialism was replaced by collective imperialism. Opportunities for capital growth were no longer linked to the military power of nations apart from the power of America. In his Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, William Blum chronicles hundreds of significant covert and overt interventions, showing exactly how the U.S. carried out its imperial management role.
On September 11th, 1973, the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a violent coup d'etat. It established a military dictatorship run by Auguste Pinochet, which would last for 17 years, resulting in the torture and murder of thousands of citizens.
U.S. National Security Advisor, 1969-73.
We had no contact with any of the people that carried out the military coup. and therefore the coup that overthrew Allende was done without contact with the United States.
Kissinger was lying. Declassified documents reveal that the coup in Chile was directed from Washington, and that the Allende regime had been under attack even before its inception. A CIA cable of October 1970 reads, "It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown in a coup." In stark contrast to what Allende had in mind as a corrective to Chile's economic woes, Pinochet would embrace a radical program of free market forms as theorized by economist Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. Friedman described himself as a libertarian with a small L, presenting his philosophy as a more moderate variant of the Austrian school of free market capitalism. He shared with them a vision in which virtually everything is owned. The programs entailed deregulation, wage reduction, attacks against unions, elimination of social spending, and a fire sale of natural resources to transnational corporations. The Western press described the events in Chile as an economic miracle.
In the post-war years, matrix reality diverged ever further from actual reality. In the post-war matrix world, imperialism had been abandoned, and the world was being, quote, democratized. In the real world, imperialism had become better organized and more efficient. In the matrix world, the U.S., quote, restored order, or, quote, came to the assistance of nations which were being, quote, undermined by Soviet influence, unquote. In the real world, the periphery was being systematically suppressed and exploited. In the matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery.
From episode 4.
Yeah, if you take a look at these ads here, which are targeted at U.S. companies to convince them to go offshore to access the low wages in El Salvador or other countries, you'll see the wage 57 cents an hour if you would go offshore. A year later, the wages are down to 33 cents an hour. This is the corporate agenda. And a part of that corporate agenda is to pit young workers in the third world against workers in the United States. We're pitted against each other in a race to the bottom. Who will accept the lowest wages? Who will accept the least benefits? Who will accept the most miserable working conditions? This is a plan. The women in El Salvador get paid 12 cents for each $20 Gap t-shirt. We have a very important question to ask. What has happened to the $19.88? Where has that disappeared to since the workers only keep 12 cents out of the shirt?
Under recent Republican administrations, the U.S. Agency for International Development has funneled well over $1 billion of taxpayers' money into creating the free trade zones. In these protected areas, corporations import materials duty-free and export the finished garments to the U.S. at special reduced tariffs. They pay no corporate taxes, no income taxes, little or no Social Security or health benefits, and they treat their workers like slaves. There are no inspections, no regulations, and when workers try to organize, they are fired.
In the matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery. Growing glitches in the matrix weren't noticed by most people in the West because the post-war years brought unprecedented levels of Western prosperity and social progress. The rhetoric claimed progress would come to all, and Westerners could see it being realized in their own towns and cities. The West became the collective core of a global empire, and exploitative development led to prosperity for Western populations, while generating immense riches for corporations, banks, and wealthy capital investors. Glitches in the Matrix, Popular Rebellion, and Neoliberalism. The parallel agenda of third world exploitation and Western prosperity worked effectively for the first two post-war decades. But in the 1960s, large numbers of Westerners, particularly the young and well-educated, began to notice glitches in the matrix. In Vietnam, imperialism was too naked to be successfully masked as something else. A major split in American public consciousness occurred as millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists punctured the fabricated consensus of the 1950s and declared the reality of exploitation and suppression, both at home and abroad. The environmental movement arose, challenging even the exploitation of the natural world. In Europe, 1968 joined 1848 as a landmark year of popular protest. These developments disturbed elite planners. The post-war regime's stability was being challenged from within the core, and the formula of Western prosperity no longer guaranteed public passivity. A report published in 1975, the report of the Trilateral Task Force on Governability of Democracies, provides a glimpse into the thinking of elite circles. Alan Wolfe discusses this report in Holly Sklar's eye-opening work, Trilateralism. Wolfe focuses especially on the analysis Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington presented in a section of the report entitled The Crisis of Democracy. Huntington is an articulate promoter of elite policy shifts and contributes pivotal articles to publications such as the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. Huntington tells us that democratic societies cannot work, quote-unquote, unless the citizenry is, quote, passive. The, quote, democratic surge of the 1960s represented an, quote, excess of democracy, which must be reduced if governments are to carry out their traditional domestic and foreign policies. Huntington's notion of traditional policies is expressed in a passage from the report, quote, to the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president, acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment. Close quote. In these few words, Huntington spells out the reality that electoral democracy has little to do with how America is run, and summarizes the kind of people who are included within the elite planning community. Who needs conspiracy theories when elite machinations are clearly described in public documents like these?
Here we must pause. Part one of The Matrix, A Further Exploration. More next week. Many thanks to Lynn Gurry and Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests. UnwelcomeGuests.net. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum. Keep living each day as though the truth were true, and please tune back in again next week. Till then.